Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Barbara Tettenborn. I'm the editor-in-chief of eLearning, and on my side today for our special episode about sodium valproate treatment in men is Tony Marston. He is professor of neurology at the University of Liverpool, where he leads the Liverpool Epilepsy Research Group, and he is consultant neurologist at the Walton Center. He is recognized very well as an international authority on epilepsy treatment and has coordinated significant multicenter trials, including the SANAT trials, which you might know from the literature, to evaluate epilepsy therapies. Hello, Tony, and thank you very much for taking your time today for our podcast. And as I already mentioned, our topic today is sodium valproate in men. I think you are the absolute expert on that topic. You have written a lot of publications on that as well. And maybe we can start as an introduction to just summarize shortly the restrictions for valproic acid treatment in women before we come to the men, because I think we all talk a lot about women and valproic acid.
Thanks, Barbara. And it's a real pleasure to join you for this podcast. And of course, we've known for a long time that sodium valproate is harmful to the development of children in utero. We've known for a long time about major malformations, and of course, over the past 20 years or so, we've been developing a really strong evidence base about developmental effects associated with exposure to valproate in utero, with around a third of children having significant reduction in their IQ. And I think I'm going to limit my discussion here to using valproate as a treatment for the idiopathic generalized epilepsies, which, as we all know, tend to present in children and adolescents and sometimes in young adults. And our focus for many years, as you've highlighted, is around treating women and how we might limit the exposure of valproate in utero. So the regulators have required the completion of risk acknowledgement forms. So on an annual basis, we should be having conversations with women about the risks associated with taking sodium valproate and the need for highly effective contraception, which in many cases will be the injectable contraceptives or Mirena coil. And the impact of these restrictions are that we will very rarely start sodium valproate as a first-line treatment for women with an idiopathic generalized epilepsy. And we will tend to start either levetiracetam or lamotrigine. My practice is to discuss the pros and cons of sodium valproate and lamotrigine levetiracetam with women with a newly diagnosed idiopathic generalized epilepsy. And in general, we'll choose an alternative to valproate. But what we know, of course, is that valproate is significantly more effective than alternatives here. So for a long time, we've had this really difficult trade-off for women, whereby we have offered them a less effective treatment as a first-line treatment because of our concerns about teratogenicity. And I think there are real concerns about the agency and the rights of women to have access to the most effective treatment. And this is a really challenging conundrum. But in general, because of the concerns, we will offer an alternative rather than valproate as a first-line treatment.
Yeah, but you mentioned that valproic acid is still the most effective drug in the treatment of primary generalized seizures and epilepsies. So in some women, it might still be necessary to give valproic acid. And you also mentioned it might be sometimes difficult to withhold the drug to the women. But now we have just lately the alert about possible teratogenic effects to children of men who take valproic acid. Can you tell us a little bit about the research background on this topic?
Yeah, and of course the concern is that the evidence is really poor in this space. So we have statements by regulators, and a great degree of uncertainty, and yet we have to make treatment decisions. I guess hence the interest in the podcast in this space. If we look back for a long time, we've had evidence from animal studies that there might be a problem. So for a long time, we've known about reduced male fertility, what we might refer to as testicular toxicity in men. And I don't think it's been routine practice to discuss this with men. And I think we've been so focused on the issues for women that we haven't been telling men about the fact that there might be reduced fertility. Although the evidence that we've had tells us that there might be a problem with testicular toxicity, but we don't have really good evidence about what impact that really has on male fertility. And there are also animal experiments which show that if you expose mice to high doses of valproate whilst pregnant, then the offspring will have autistic tendencies. And one of the ways to generate an animal model of autism is to expose mice to high levels of valproate in utero. So we've known about this potential mechanism for a long time. More recently, there's been work done based on the Scandinavian linked registries, which highlight that there might be a higher risk of neurodevelopmental delay in children born to men taking sodium valproate. And the size of the effect is where that there's about 5 in 100 children born to men taking valproate with potential developmental disorder, and 3 in 100 where the men was taking lamotrigine and levetiracetam as controls. The real challenge is to know what the cause of that is. Is it really the drugs that's causing that, or is it some other confounding factor? And of course, the initial analysis that was presented to the regulators had some problems with it, and there's had to be a reanalysis. So whilst the data suggests that there might be a problem, we don't have any confidence that the effect is true. The other thing to say is that the other concern is around transgenerational effects. So if we go back to the mice experiments, if we make mice autistic or have autistic traits by exposing them to valproate in utero, their offspring will also have similar traits, presumably due to an epigenetic mechanism. So I think there's a lot of concern in the background about potential transgenerational effects, although that hasn't really featured in the statements by regulators. So we're in this really difficult position whereby we have some potential risks highlighted, but we're completely uncertain about whether those risks are true. And then the question is, well, what should be the regulators' response to that? And this is really challenging for the regulators, because if they don't take action, they'll be criticized. But if they overreact, they'll also be criticized. My perception is that there's been a bit of an overreaction, particularly in the UK, about this matter. But it doesn't change the fact that we have uncertainty, and it is possible that children born to men taking valproate are exposed to avoidable harm.
So you think it's okay, of course, to explain all this to men who take valproic acid and plan on having children, but do you think it's also okay to have this annual signature, like for the women, so that you really can prove that you have explored everything, which makes it a lot of hassle for especially neurologists in private practice if they have an annual replay of all these procedures?
Yeah, so it requires balance, doesn't it, and a sensible approach to risk. And I think one of the challenges for the regulators is that they have a very one-dimensional view of risk. If we are very conservative and avoiding prescribing valproate to men despite really poor evidence, we're going to harm men, because not controlling people's epilepsy results in injury and will inevitably result in a small number of deaths. So it is not a trivial thing to do to reduce prescribing of the most effective treatment for what is potentially a life-threatening condition. So there really needs to be balance here. And the bureaucratic response is really harmful, isn't it? And so the bureaucratic response results in important clinical time being taken filling in forms, and often forms for people with really well-controlled epilepsy. If neurologists are spending a lot of time filling in forms, then they might be spending less time seeing people with really severe epilepsy. And on balance, you would argue as a clinician that you want to spend your time helping people that have got a really severe, potentially life-threatening problem, rather than filling in forms with people whose epilepsy is really well-controlled. In the UK, there's been some backtracking. The initial intent when there was an announcement just over a year ago was that we would have to complete annual forms for men. The state in the UK at the moment is that we have to fill in a form when we start sodium valproate, and that form has to be filled in by two independent neurologists, but there is no follow-up. So for our men in the UK, we have a form when we start it, but no other forms. And for our men that are already taking sodium valproate, we don't need to complete any forms at all.
Makes it a little bit easier than in some other European countries. There is a risk of, for example, sudden death in epilepsy if you withdraw valproic acid from a patient who is well treated under valproic acid. So it's not so easy. Maybe you can just say a few words about this increase of sudden death and other risk complications on withdrawal of valproic acid to a well-treated patient.
Yeah, so if you look at the data from the SANAD trial, there's about a 20% difference in the proportion of people achieving a remission of their seizures on a valproate versus levetiracetam. So it's probably that kind of ballpark difference. So if we swap people with well-controlled epilepsy from valproate to an alternative, it's likely that around 20% are not going to have their epilepsy controlled on the alternative treatment. And that comes at a cost. We looked at this last year in a paper that was published in Brain, in one of the big American databases. And what we actually discovered was that withdrawal of valproate was associated with a number of adverse consequences, including injury, fracture, hospital admissions, emergency department attendance, and poorer mental health. What we didn't find was any signal of increased mortality, which came as a surprise to us. So in theory, there's a risk of death, but we didn't actually pick that up in the analysis for that paper. But what's very clear is that withdrawal of valproate is associated with harm, which comes at cost to individuals and also cost to health economies, whereby more time in the emergency department, more time with neurologists and others clearly comes at a cost. And often these things aren't factored into regulatory decisions, where there is often a very unidimensional, blinkered view about risk of the treatment, and no or very little consideration of the risk associated with not having the treatment.
So it's good to know that the risk of mortality is not increased, but there is harm to the patient and with social consequences and maybe also an impact on the society, because the costs are increased for, as you mentioned, several more hospital admissions for fractures and because of a new seizure and things like that.
Yeah. So I don't think we can say there is no increased risk of death. It's likely that there will be an increased risk of death, but that risk is small and the tip of an iceberg, and the rest of the iceberg is all of that other morbidity that's caused by lack of access to what is an effective treatment.
What is your advice to a general neurologist in private practice who is not such a specialist as you are and knows all the background in treating usually young patient with primary generalized seizures or epilepsy, male versus female?
It's tricky, isn't it? So the advice, of course, is to explain to patients with a newly diagnosed epilepsy about the pros and cons of the treatment options for women. That's a conversation which we will probably bias the woman towards not choosing valproate in the way that we describe it, and that's probably reasonable. But our approach is to not use valproate as a first line treatment for women with an idiopathic generalized epilepsy, accepting that some women might choose it and make a very clear view that valproate would be their first treatment. But in general, we'll recommend levetiracetam or lamotrigine as the first line treatment for idiopathic generalized epilepsy. But once that treatment has failed, there is then the option of choosing valproate, or then choosing valproate after a second treatment has failed. So what we need to remember is that valproate remains an alternative and it's a really effective treatment, but we might choose it as a second or a third line for women with idiopathic generalized epilepsy. For men, the conversation is different, I think. Here, I think men have more option to choose sodium valproate as a first line treatment. So in my practice, for men, I still explain the fact that valproate's more effective. There's about a 20% difference between it and levetiracetam or lamotrigine, but there's these uncertainties around teratogenicity and male fertility, and encourage the men to make a decision. And they might want to go away and think about it and come back. And I think what we need to remember is that most people with a newly diagnosed idiopathic generalized epilepsy have relatively infrequent seizures, particularly tonic-clonic seizures are relatively infrequent, particularly in adult practice. So there is no immediate rush to make a decision at the appointment. But there is kind of a cool-off period to follow that up.
But you will still keep valproic acid as a drug of first choice for the male patients, for the men?
Yeah, so my current practice is to do that and to explain to men this is the regulatory position, go through the risk acknowledgement form. And if the man makes a very clear decision that they want sodium valproate, then it's not for me to deny them access to the most effective treatment for their epilepsy.
I think this is already a kind of a summary, but do you have an additional take-home message for our listeners? We have usually, especially young listeners who might not be as experienced as you are.
I think the take-home here is that we need to understand that sodium valproate is the most effective treatment. Not prescribing it is associated with harm, but also prescribing it is associated with harm. Ultimately, we can't be autocratic. We have to have space for conversation with patients to discuss the pros and cons, to allow them to make an informed decision as to what they want.
Thank you very much. It was a very interesting talk, and I think it helps our listeners a lot in their clinical practice in treating patients with epilepsy. Thank you, Tony.
It's been my pleasure to talk to you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.